Elliot Carter was born in New York City. He is one of America's leading composers. His awards and honors are the highest a composer can receive. Two Pulitzer Prizes, honorary degrees from Harvard, Yale, and Princeton universities, membership in both the American Academy and the Institute of Arts and Letters, and a gold medal from the latter. Membership in the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, honorary membership at the Akademie der Künste in Berlin, and the impressive Ernst von Semmerer Musikpreis. Did I get that right, Mr. Carter?
It's von Siemens.
Von Siemens, sorry. Thank you.
Sure.
That was in 1981, I believe. Previously awarded to composers Benjamin Britten, Olivier Messiaen, and Pierre Boulez, and many eminent performers. He is also a scholar, an author, and a teacher. Mr. Carter, did I get the highlights of your life there? Anything you'd like to add?
Well, I always feel the highlights of my life are my music, I guess that's about all there is to say verbally.
Sure. We're going to get to your music. As I told the audience, we're going to have an afternoon of the music of Elliot Carter. I want to read something here that interests me. This is a quote that you wrote. It said, "I am told that the line of continuity of my works is very definite, each deriving from the previous one with no apparent or little apparent relationship to the various musical trends that have come and gone during the past 40 years. Well, that would say to me that you have somehow resisted going along with the style of the moment. And I wondered if that was a conscious decision on your part, or how did you manage to do that?
Well, you see, I don't think that music comes out of following a trend. It comes out of the conception of the composer, and I've simply developed what I thought I liked to write, and each piece led to the next. They had their own life like a tree, and the idea that you'd have to start stunting the tree as the Japanese do is not something I felt I wanted to do in my life.
Yes, well, it's certainly better to do it that way, and yet we do have music trends that a lot of composers do follow.
Well, I think that in a sense, my music is every piece of music is a comment on the trends of the time in which it was written. That is, that it represents a distancing from those trends, as well as a knowledge. After all, I was a critic, and in that book of my writings, there are reviews of almost all pieces written during a certain period until I stopped being a critic. My wife and I ran contemporary music groups in New York City, the ISCM and the League of Composers, for many years, and so I was very familiar with everything that was being written in both in the United States and in Europe. I always have been.
And you're explaining a great deal about what I was interested in next in that statement that I just quoted from. What you said there was, the next step had to be taken, and this is what I have tried to do insofar as my work can be said to adopt any aesthetic position. For I have been more concerned with writing the works than in demonstrating aesthetic notions.
Well, I think so. The aesthetic notions that have been prevalent in the 20th century, and of course they're a very large number, should, whenever they have any validity, should be the result of an inner vision of the individual composer that develops them. I mean, certainly for instance, the neoclassicism of Stravinsky was a specific attitude toward romantic music, toward the primitivist music that he'd been writing before that, and I think he was taking a specific view, distancing himself, so to speak, from the romantic style, and finding in composers like Bach and even other composers previous to Bach a certain way of dealing with feelings in music that the romantics were not interested in.
You also said said this, that the initial influence of your works may have been the constructivism prevalent in American music in the 20s and the 30s, somewhat related to Scriabin, Roosevelt's, and the Schoenberg School. Ives, Varese, Ruggles, and Ruth Crawford all had certain tendencies in that direction, as did Copeland and Sessions.
Of course, I was a personal friend of Varese for a good part of until when I was old enough to be a friend. I was also a friend of Charles Ives, and I am still a friend of Aaron Copland and Roger Sessions. These people have been very, very close and intimate to me, and Henry Cowell, and I became interested in music by hearing contemporary music when I was a boy in high school, in the around 1922 or 3, and it was mainly the music of Stravinsky and Varese and Schoenberg that got me going on music, and as a result I developed from that school, and I've always felt in a certain sense all my music is all an extension of that early sort of advanced music, which is not so advanced anymore, although I think to the large public it still remains very puzzling.
You worked, as I understand, with Walter Piston, Archibald T. Davison, Edward Hill, Gustav Holst, and Nadia Boulanger, whom I think everybody has worked with, who's
yes.
into music. What sort of influence did these people have upon you? Do you see any influence of them in your work?
Not in any specific way. I don't think you could point your finger. I think certainly the thing that both Walter Piston and Nadia Boulanger gave to a student, to their students, and to me as well as others, was a profound concern for music, for the material of music, and a sense of responsibility toward the musical profession, and a sense of responsibility towards performers, and toward the history of music, and an effort to say, so to speak, to write what seemed and still seems to me to be really very good music, and to try to channel your effort toward what you thought was the very best you could do. It was a kind of very, almost a moral point of view about this. That is a very strongly devoted to an aesthetic of a serious approach to the field of music, because neither one of them were believed in seriousness as in the sense that a German might, but they thought you ought to be serious about even funny things.
Yes, because the music of that era, I think that you mentioned somewhere in that writing, which I quoted from before, that one of the things that interested you was the, I think you termed it, playfulness sometimes of the music of that time.
Oh, yes. And some people seem to, many people think that a great deal of my music is playful.
Is it?
I won't answer that because I don't know. I've forgotten. Let me put
another
it that way.
Another description of your music has been, and certainly not in a pejorative way, that it is less accessible than some of your contemporaries. Would you feel that's justified as a comment or?
Well, it's more accessible to me, obviously.
I would think it is. Yes.
but on the other hand, it seems to me that you are talking, if you make a general statement about my contemporaries, there seem to me many contemporaries, since I'm now almost 74,
I'm thinking more of the contemporaries you mentioned, that of good friends of yours, Copeland and Ives and some of the other people, not Ives, but some of the other people that you had mentioned, because...
Well, I don't know that Varese's music is very accessible. I don't really know that. I don't find it puzzling myself, but I don't see it played very often, and I don't know if that's a sign. What that's an indication of. There are certainly many of the works of Schoenberg, if he could be considered a contemporary, although he seems to me a predecessor rather.
Yes.
It remains puzzling, I think, to many people, and certainly the works of Webern and I don't know who, and a great many of the people that have followed him since. Let us say a composer like Boulez, remains inaccessible to quite a large number of people. This seems to me a rather irrelevant matter,
mm-hmm.
because it seems to me that in the end, almost all music is inaccessible to most people, and only a certain amount of music. The music, for instance, that that the music of Beethoven, for instance, was certainly considered rather inaccessible in its time for most people, because when they played Beethoven symphonies, they always had to sing Italian arias between the movements to keep people from going to sleep. And the man who performed the Beethoven violin concerto on the same program played some sort of a piece with a violin behind his back to keep the audience interested.
You know, I think that perhaps in the ultimate, that all comments on music are irrelevant.
But I feel that the question of accessibility is not something that I'm prepared to consider seriously. My own works were that you will play on this program, like Pocahontas, was considered totally inaccessible at the time that it was written. Now it seems like something that it's very hard for people to understand that anyone ever thought that. And this is exactly not that I compare myself with Brahms, but it's certainly true of the Brahms symphonies. When they were written, Mahler said there wasn't a note of music in them.
Mm. Well, it's always, I guess, that the accessibility is in the ear of the listener, perhaps. Or his brain.
Yeah, I know, and I think it's in the ear of the listener who's listened a lot will find that the inaccessible things become accessible. In fact, one of the most interesting experiences, I think, in everybody's life must be the finding out of information that they they originally didn't know and were able finally to comprehend.
Well, I think your point is certainly well taken, and we're going to act upon that by letting the listener make decisions upon the music himself or herself. We'll be listening to a piece of your music here in just a moment, the Holiday Overture. Before we do, I do want to mention, in case there are people who will not be able to hear the rest of our conversation later on and more of your music, there is a concert, as I understand, tonight in which some of your music is going to be performed at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And Lucas Foss is conducting that, is that correct?
That's right, yes. It's a ballet suite that was written for the predecessor of the New York City Ballet. George Balanchine and I were the librettists, and John Tarras was the choreographer. And it was done, I think, around 1948.
All right, then certainly you might want to hear that program tonight at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. It's also going to be Saturday evening and then again on Sunday afternoon, the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And you'll hear music by contemporary composers, including our guest here this afternoon and around New York, Elliot Carter. The Holiday Overture was written in 1944, and I believe you revised it in 1961.
Very slightly. Actually, it was hardly changed at all. There were just a few little details. When it came to be printed, it won a prize in 1944, given by the independent music publishers, of which Aaron Copland was one of the judges, and I think Dr. Kusevitsky was another. And the work had a very curious career. It was scheduled to be played by the Boston Symphony since Dr. Kusevitsky gave it the prize, but then he kept postponing it. And finally, someone in the American Army asked me if they could play a piece, and I got the part secretly out of the Boston Symphony Library and sent them to Germany, and it was his first performance was in Frankfurt in Germany just after it had been liberated by the American Army.
The piece was written as
a commemoration of the end of the war. It was written in the time when the D-Day was happening in August of 1944.
Why did you have to get it secretly out of the...
Because Kusevitsky made it clear that he had to have the first performance, and he wouldn't allow the parts to get out, and I got a little tired of waiting for this to go on and on, so a year later I sort of took it away from him, and it never did get played by the Boston Symphony until many, many years later when Aaron Copland conducted it there.
That's fascinating. Well, we'll listen now to the Holiday Overture. Do you have any other comments you want to make on it before we listen to it?
Well, the work has been played a great deal. It was played 3-4 times by the New York Philharmonic. It's played all over the country. It's rather, it's very much a very typical work of its period, of the 40s, and it's almost the last work I wrote that is in a comparatively conventional form. And a more or less conventional in mood, I think, rather than very jubilant piece.
All right, well, we'll hear that work now. This performed by the American Composers Orchestra, Paul Dunkel conducting. Thank you. We are listening to the music of Elliot Carter this afternoon here on FM 94. These are taken, the selections, from two new CRI recordings, which has the music of Elliot Carter and spans a large range of his works, going back to some of the earlier works and then some of the more recent ones that he's done. We've just heard the Holiday Overture, which was composed in 1944 and slightly revised in 1961. This is CRI recording SD-475. We have the pleasure and honor of having Mr. Carter here this afternoon on us with FM 94. And also I'd like to remind you that his music, some of his music, is going to be played tonight on a Music of 20th Century Composers program at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, Lucas Foss conducting the Brooklyn Philharmonia Orchestra. And that program, I understand, is going to be repeated tomorrow night and then again on Sunday afternoon. You can get more details from the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Mr. Carter, earlier I had mentioned the word inaccessible about your music, and we took that up very thoroughly. The other comment I have heard is that quite often your music is very difficult to perform. Technically, it is quite complicated. I was reminded of a particular performance of your piano concerto by Samuel Lipman, conducted by Gerard Schwartz a few years ago in Colorado. And they had not really had sufficient rehearsal time and were a little concerned about whether, as I told you, the piece would come off. Would you like to make any comments on that? Do you know more about that?
Well, after all, the Aspen Symphony at that time was partially a professional one and partly a student one. And actually, it was a rather good performance, considering the fact that the students, there were quite a large number of students participating. The work is somewhat, I suppose it's difficult, but the thing about difficult music is that it gets easy. That people, Mahler's symphonies were excessively difficult at the time they were written, and I'm sure that Bach probably never had a very accurate performance of any of his pieces during his lifetime. The writing, for instance, for the trumpet and some of the cantatas is unbelievably difficult. The writing for horn and some of the Mozart pieces is and the clarinet must have been extremely difficult at that time. Now students play them, and this is true of my music. Many of the pieces that were at one time difficult, like this Holiday Overture, are played in conservatories around the country, and the question of difficulty is mainly a difficulty of when at first sight pieces become easier, and the fact that if music didn't have difficult pieces, then the performers wouldn't develop. And so we really need difficult pieces in order to help the profession get better.
Well, I think you're certainly doing your bit to help them.
Well, I think that my pieces are not difficult because just for difficulty's sake.
Oh, no.
They're difficult because they present many sorts of unusual conceptions about music, and also because they just make demands on the performing skills. But my God, some of the Strauss operas, for instance, are more difficult than anything I've written, I think.
On that note, I want to mention something about Strauss to you. I had thought about this. Richard Strauss, at the end of the Second World War, had been living in, a mountain town in Germany. I forget just what place it was.
And Garmisch.
Was that where it was? And
yes.
The American, maybe you know the story, the American soldiers came in and took over the area, and he, as I understand, was quite frightened because he'd heard stories about how the Allies were going to probably do him harm or if not kill him. So when they came in and they knocked on his door and he opened the door and in a very frightened manner he said, I am Richard Strauss, the composer of Der Rosenkavalier. I don't know what went on in his mind at the time, but certainly he wanted very much to be identified with that work, whether he thought it was his most popular work or his best work or whatever. And the reason that I'm telling you this story, I wanted to ask you, heaven forbid that you should ever be caught in such a similar situation, what of your works would you like to be identified with under such circumstances?
I thought the rest of that story was that the American soldier went in and said, I also composer of Electra and Salome. I thought the rest of the story was that the soldier knew more about it than Strauss expected.
Oh, I see.
And
well,
that's what I would expect in my case.
Suffice to say, they didn't harm him, of course, thanks be. But the point that I was trying to get at it, under extreme circumstances, I've always wondered why he identified with Der Rosenkavalier. We'll never know, of course.
Well, it's because it was most frequently played, I think, of his operas. And he probably knew that it had been played in America many times before the war, and I don't know, probably was played during the war, too.
I think it was, yes.
And after all, it contains all those waltzes he swiped from all the other Viennese composers.
Well, to get back to you, there was one thing I wanted to ask you about. I'm always interested in the creative process, and I wondered what is your procedure in composing. I know that some composers tell me that they wait for the muse to sing and inspire them. Others say that they simply have a habit of doing some writing at frequent periods with a schedule that they set up. What is your procedure?
Well, I work a bit different. It depends on in what stage the work is in. I don't have a procedure. I start by trying to think of the kind of work I want to write, and particularly what kind of instruments I'm going to use or what kind of musical forces, whether an orchestra. And then I try to think of ideas or a musical character that I would like to hear. And then gradually a piece begins to form. I can't say that I write these pieces in the order, and I don't just sit down and write them off like a letter.
No, because
for the very simple reason is that the music that I write, every single piece of mine approaches music from a different point of view, so that no piece is basically a help in a previous piece. As a result, each piece is, in fact, I like to have each piece a kind of adventure, so that I don't know how it will turn out until it's all over with. And this very quality, I feel, is part of the character of my music, gives my music a certain character that prevents it from ever being cut and dried or from repeating patterns either of its predecessors of mine, but of its historical predecessors. So that my music is really constantly an adventurous kind of thing within itself, each particular piece, so that I can't say that I have a formula about how to write it. Each piece comes and comes and comes in a different way. In the piece, for instance, this concerto for orchestra, I was very concerned with treating the orchestra as a crowd of people. I had written all pieces like string quartets and violin sonatas, and I was very interested in writing pieces in all of those works and individualizing the separate players that contributed to it, and I thought I would like to expand this to a vast scale in an orchestra piece, so that I wanted to give the impression that every member of the orchestra somehow had his music and was contributing to the total effect in his own particular way, rather than all being herded together as they are in traditional music. And so I wanted to have the impression that there's a large democracy in which everybody was sort of contributing, doing his bit for it, but in his own way. And this made for infinite kinds of problems and also very stimulating thoughts about how to deal with this. And finally, after I'd written a good part of the piece, the concept began to dawn on me of what I was trying to do, and I found a poem which then articulated in a little more clear way what I was doing and then helped me to complete the piece.
We, just for the benefit of the audience listening now, are going to hear that concerto in just a few moments. And I know that you have to leave not too long from now, so I want to just get your ideas on a couple of other items.
Sure.
You have been through many eras and styles of music. I mentioned that before, and you had mentioned yourself that a lot of times your composition, rather than following the style of the day, was a comment on a particular musical idiom of the day. The question I have now is, how would you characterize our new music of today? I know that's a difficult question today because, unlike so many other of our eras in the past, there seems to be so many different kinds of contemporary current music.
I don't think that's true. I don't agree with that.
You don't think it's true?
I think that throughout the 20th century there have been every conceivable style of music has been being written from the very beginning. The reason why it seems what you say seems to be true is because the composers, say, of the avant-garde period of Stravinsky and Schoenberg and before the First World War and immediately afterward, did what they did in such a convincing way that they drew all the attention away from Herr Schrecker and I don't know who, Mr. Converse in this country, or even Douglas Moore, or we could list hundreds of composers, some of them writing conservative music, some of them writing romantic music, some of them writing... every conceivable style was being written in even before the First World War and then continued to be all the way... And when you got to the 20s and 30s, there were people still writing like the early Stravinsky and Schoenberg. There were also people writing like Mio and Hindemith. There were also people writing like Wagner. There were also people, God knows, writing like Brahms. I don't think it's any different than it is now. Uh-huh. The only thing is that those people that emerged in every one of those periods were people that were able to do something in such a valid way that they finally became the person, the people that are generally known in from that period. I mean, Hindemith, for instance, it became very well known because his music was so much more striking than, let us say, the imitators of Wagner and Mahler like Korngold, for instance, was one of that particular period. Because his music had a great deal of character of its own, and it also had a very special vision. It's now there are composers at the present time who write like Hindemith. We have all of the whole panorama of music being represented at the present time. I don't feel it's any different. The only thing that's different now is that nobody has any discrimination about it.
Oh. Well, would you say that we're in a golden era?
I have no idea.
Are we too close to it?
I don't think that as the music world goes at this particular time, it's nearly impossible to say that because with the great decline in people's ability to discriminate has come such an overwhelming mass of things. We are totally unable to judge anything. We can't tell what is good from what is bad because we don't have a chance to have somebody else single out one thing from another. I mean, you go to some of our well-known performing organizations, and they will play contemporary music. Some of it incompetent, from the point of view of my the composer doesn't know how to orchestrate, but they will play it anyhow, and it will sound in some way to the critic quite novel because it's so badly orchestrated. That is, it doesn't know how it to do with the trombone or what I don't know what. Now, this is a new phase that we've never had before. That's the only novelty about our period. There's no discrimination.
Well, you've said now what you don't like about the music of today.
I'm saying there also have been music that in previous times were filtered out by professionals because the professionals were far more interested in promoting contemporary music of a certain style, of a certain character, of certain importance than they are now.
What of today's music do you like very much? I mean, I don't mean specifically, but what trends or...
I won't talk about my colleagues in general.
No, I don't want
because
to.
Because there are certainly very interesting composers alive today and very important ones, I think.
No, I only meant the question was you said what you didn't like about some of the music. The lack of discrimination is something you don't like. Well, something similar
to that
you might like.
Well, I feel that the interesting and good pieces are swamped by this enormous, when we ran the, let's just take the case of when we ran the League of Composers, we knew quite well what we thought was good music. It may have been people thought we were very prejudiced, but for instance, it was very obvious that Aaron Copland was a very important composer back from the very beginning, and we always played whatever we could play, and we repeated the pieces from one year to the next, and This was true of Varese and a great many other composers. This, if there are Varese's equivalents of Varese's and Copland's today, nobody's getting behind them the way they did in the old days. That makes a lot of difference.
Yes. You think then the cream will rise to the top?
Well, I think people get awfully bored with mediocrity.
All right, let's turn now to your music, the concerto, which we mentioned we were going to listen to. Now, let's see, when was this composed?
This was composed for the 125th anniversary of the New York Philharmonic and was performed in 1970. I can't tell you when it was composed. It was probably composed about a year or two before that time.
Sure. The notes that I had here were that it was, as you said, to celebrate the 125th anniversary.
Yeah.
They also commissioned your symphony of
three orchestras. Right. That was later.
Yeah, that was in 1976.
This work was commissioned by Leonard Bernstein at a time when Leonard Bernstein was a conductor, and it was performed along with a great many other works commissioned for that particular anniversary. It was then later performed by Boulez when he conducted the New York Philharmonic, and even he devoted an entire evening of the Philharmonic to this work with a lecture about it on myself and himself with examples. And then it's been played. Most recent performance that I know of was done at the Venice Biennale last year.
And the work that we are going to hear, the recording that we're going to hear in just a moment, is a reissue on CRI of the Concerto for Orchestra that was originally done by Leonard Bernstein, as you said, with the New York Philharmonic.
That was done very shortly after the first performance, I think a few days after the first playings of the piece in 1970.
Now, you have some quotes, I think, that are from your manuscript there that you can share.
Well, as I was saying before, the conception of the piece was to treat the orchestra as a large group of individuals and in the sense of giving every individual somehow a part and having a piece emerge from this large sort of group of soloists, all of them having certain kinds of individualized things. And as I got along in the piece, I discovered a poem. It was a poem that Stephen Spender had once told me was interesting, and it's a poem by a French poet, St. John Pass, and it's about America. And as you see, one of the problems, one of the things that one thinks about as an American composer is one's relations with one's country. And certainly the work of the Holiday Overture is a sort of an example of American music, as is that symphony, the first symphony that you will play, and also Pocahontas, the ballet. However, after that, I began to think that maybe being American was not something you wore on your sleeve, that every action of every American is the making of America. And therefore, it seemed to me that I need no longer think about the question of being American as a conscious thing. However, at this particular piece got back into this thought to a certain extent. And the poem of St. John Pass, of which I'll read you some in English, is a description. He was an ambassador, one of France's leading poets, but he was an ambassador to the United States and lived here during the war. And it was written after the war. And I would like to read some excerpts. The piece begins, it's about its winds, and the idea, the picture of this poem is about winds flying over the United States and sweeping away the old things and bringing in the new. And the whole work of sounds like wind, like something like a great flow and rushing of things and a constant turning over of things. And so I'd like to read a little bit of it. The beginning is a description of the wind. These were very great winds over all the faces of this world, very great winds rejoicing over the world, having nor eyrie nor resting place, having nor care nor caution, and leaving us in their wake, men of straw in a year of straw. Ah, yes, very great winds over all the faces of the living. And then there's a movement one, which describes sort of the past. And having exposed to the air the attrition and drought in the heart of men in office, behold, they produce this taste of straw and spices in the squares of all our cities, ebbed from the great works of the, and divinity ebbed from the great works of the spirit. for a whole century was rustling in the dry sound of its straw amid strange dissonances at the tips of husks of pods, at the tips of trembling things. And then the second movement is a description of the country itself. New lands out there and their very lofty perfume of humus and foliage, new lands out there beneath the lengthening of this world's most expansive shadows. All the land of trees out there, its background of black veins like a Bible of shadow and freshness in the unrolling of this world's most beautiful texts. And then there's a rather beautiful thing about the flights of insects. Those flights of insects going off in clouds to lose themselves at sea like fragments of sacred texts, like the tatters of errant prophecies and of recitations by genealogists, by psalmists. One has told them, ah, what has not one told them, that they should lose themselves on the seas and they should put about. One cried to them, and what did not one cry to them? That they should return, should return among us. But no, they went their way instead, where one is lost in the wind. And then there's the third movement, which is about the poet who's trying to bring start the new age again. For man is in question and his reintegration. Will no one in the world raise his voice, testimony for man? Let the poet speak and let him guide the judgment. And quote, litigation, I ignore you, and my opinion is that we should live with the torch in the wind, with the flame in the wind, and that all men amongst us should be so mingled and consumed therein that this growing torch may kindle within us a greater clarity. And then there's a fourth movement, which is the final resolution of this. And again, man casts his shadow on the causeway of men, and the smoke of man is on the roofs, the movement of the men on the road, and the season of man like a new theme on our lips. And the poem finally ends and our poems will go forth again on the roadway of men, bearing seeds and fruit in the lineage of men of another age. A new race among the men of my race, a new race among the daughters of my race, and my cry of a living being on the causeway of men, from place to place and from man to man, unto the distant shores where death deserts. So this is a poem, this kind of, it's rather Whitman-esque for a Frenchman, I think.
It certainly sounds that way.
In any case, this was something that got me, sort of helped me to integrate the entire piece. And the piece, let me say, is not in movements as I've described them. All movements are heard all the time. It's like a movie in which you one movement comes into focus and you hear the other ones in the background, and then another one comes into focus, so that each movement has its sort of comes to a foreground, but there are always elements of all the other material throughout, like a kind of great hurricane.
Well, we're going to hear that right now, but just a second before we do, I would like to give you the last word. If there is anything else you'd like to say before leaving us, I know you have to leave now. Would certainly be a pleasure to hear what you have to say. Anything in leaving, any parting thoughts, anything we didn't cover?
Well, I'm not at all pessimistic about contemporary music, as you might imagine. In fact, I want to say one thing, that to me throughout my life, contemporary music has always been very much more interesting than older music. And I find contemporary music that is of any quality at all. And in fact, one loves to go to concerts and hear pieces that you don't know how they will turn out as you listen to them and you hear them. And each one, as I write my own pieces, each one of the new pieces that I hear, to me, is a kind of adventure. And I find that it's far more interesting to hear something that I don't know and don't know what to expect than to hear the music that I do know and know what to expect. And I'm always quite surprised that audiences don't feel the same way.
Well, there is one thing about that I do think, and I had meant to ask you, it didn't seem to materialize during the previous conversation. On the CRI recordings, which we are playing now, there is a large range of your work, from some of the early music that you wrote to some of the more recent. As you listen to the contrasts of your styles in these early selections from the later ones, what goes on in your mind as to how you changed or why you changed?
I must say I've thought about this a great deal. And so many things go on in my mind I can't tell you about them. I think I, There was a period when I first started to write the kind of music I now write, when I thought that I should destroy all of this older music, that it didn't represent what I really believed in. And then after a while I realized that a man lives his life, and the past is one part of his life and the present is another, and that you have to accept the past. Now I rather like what I did in the past, so that I can't say, but there was a period when I began to think, it seemed to me that it was rather trivial and superficial.
Mr. Carter, I want to thank you not only for coming over to WNYC-FM and sharing your art and your knowledge with us. I'd also like to thank you so much for all the compositions you've made over the years and helping us to stretch our minds and our ears. I think you've played a very important role in that area, if you understand what I mean.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. We're going to hear now the Concerto for Orchestra. This is a reissue of the recording made by the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. It's on a CRI recording, a new release, and the number is SD-469, Elliot Carter's Concerto for Orchestra.
Thank you.
Thank you.